Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed. So I call your name, your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Bob Ginsberg. Our guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Browdy. Before we get going, a couple of housekeeping notes. I would like to mention that we have our mediumship raffle in full swing right now. The sales of raffles have been brisk. We have five mediums, but two new ones that are world class. We have John Holland, you can win a reading with John. Also, Sandra O'Connor, who was featured in the Netflix Surviving Death series, and of course, three other Forever Family Foundation certified mediums. As we've mentioned before, our grief retreat in the summer in Connecticut filled up very, very quickly. We are in the process of negotiating another one in California that will be in October. And we have another one in January. That's all set, and the details on those will be posted on our website soon. Okay, enough of that. Let me introduce our guest, Stephen Browdy. He studied philosophy and English at Oberlin College at the University of London. And in 1971, yes, he is that old, well, he won't admit it, he received his PhD in philosophy from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's emeritus professor and former chair of the philosophy department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He's editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration. Steve is the recipient of numerous grants, fellowships, and awards. He's published 7 books and more than 100 chapters and essays in philosophical and scientific journals. We're going to be talking about his latest book tonight, which is Dangerous Pursuits: Mediumship, Mind, and Music. Steve is also on the Forever Family Foundation Academic Advisory Board. And his personal website is jazzphilosopher.com, and that also links to his more academic university site. Well, welcome to the show, my friend. Nice to talk to you again.
It's good talking to you, too. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And, you know, in looking around, obviously we're going to be talking about the new book. You know, when I look in the field of people that study non-physical phenomena, I see most of the researchers and scientists have their degrees in psychology. And I'm always looking at the differences, you know. So if we accept the definition of philosophy as the study of the fundamental nature of knowledge or reality and existence, and psychology as the study of the human mind, which discipline is better suited to the exploration of non-physical phenomena? Any opinion?
I'm biased, of course. I mean, I'd say that philosophy is at the root of every science. There's no such thing as a purely empirical inquiry. Yeah. So every science rests on various, ultimately abstract assumptions about such things as the nature of observation, the nature of evidence, methodological assumptions, philosophical assumptions about the nature of perception, and so on. So there's no escaping it. And back in the good old days of philosophy, you know, around 2000 BC, there was no real difference between philosophy and natural science. They were considered the same discipline. It's only after the various branches of science became more systematic and more empirically rich that they went off on their own. And unfortunately, I would say that many scientists lost sight of their philosophical roots and forgot about just how tentative all scientific pronouncements are.
It certainly seems that philosophy is a much broader perspective and all inclusive, as you mentioned. So I wonder why there are so few of your colleagues that are philosophers that are involved in this pursuit. You know, it's you've sort of led the way, but not that many have followed in your footsteps.
Well, that's because of the cutthroat nature of academia. I mean, I didn't do this until I got tenure. I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid.
That's right. So, Dangerous Pursuits, intriguing title, you know, mediumship, mind, and music. You go into a broad range of things. You did start with something that I'd like to ask you about. You know, many, many years ago, you were experimenting with some friends and you had some experience with table movements. And you mentioned at the time that it scared you. And you know, being the inquisitive mind that you are, you wanted to determine, well, why did it affect you that way? And you discounted the obvious explanation that simple fear of the unknown was the culprit. So what was the deeper explanation of your fear?
It was that possibly one or more of us at the sitting around the table had caused the table to rise. And that suggests a kind of causal connection, which I think scares a lot of people very deeply. And it's one of the reasons very few people in philosophy take parapsychology seriously. I mean, the way I like to explain it is this. Suppose you can move a pencil or a matchstick a millimeter by thought alone. It's a very small step conceptually from doing that to making somebody drop dead by thought alone. So the existence of any PK in the world forces us to take seriously a kind of magical worldview that most of us associate, usually condescendingly, only with so-called primitive cultures. It's a worldview in which our thoughts, maybe our unconscious thoughts, have all sorts of possibly malevolent or lethal consequences, and in which we'd have to take responsibility for a range of things we'd just as soon be bystanders for. So, I mean, there are certainly cultures around the world, usually in underdeveloped countries, where people take this kind of thing as a matter of course. But in industrialized nations, it doesn't go down very easily. Mm-hmm. I mean, science has been working steadily for a couple of centuries to make causation increasingly impersonal. And the existence of psychic phenomena makes it look like the so-called primitives may have had it right all along.
And, you know, and we come across this even, you know, in the work that we do and, you know, working with the bereaved and things like mediumship, you know, and there still is that element of fear in a lot of people. But I have noticed, I mean, we're making the assumption that that there are, you know, negative and positive forces at play, both in our physical world and possibly beyond. But it was always curious to me that after witnessing probably 1,000 medium readings over the years, rarely, if ever, does any negative information come through, you know? And I always wondered about that, you know, why? Well, I ask mediums and they say, well, they surround themselves, you know, with light, and they ask their guides to, you know, to protect them and have no negative information come through. But maybe it has more to do with assuming that, you know, we survive our physical deaths, that we have a different perspective there. And maybe unlike the physical world where negative and positive seem to be balanced, there's more positive than negative on the other side. Just pure conjecture, but
it's an interesting conjecture, and it may be that in certain kinds of situations that is the spirit, no pun intended, that predominates. But in lots of poltergeist cases and in other sorts of cases, nastiness may be more prevalent.
Mm. So you've been critical over the years about some of the research that takes place and the scientific methodology used, and you point out that we often make experiments so complicated that it actually may prevent the emergence of psi phenomena. So the big question is, can something that is spontaneous in nature, like psi phenomena, actually be dissected in a lab?
My hunch is that it's probably as inappropriate as asking people to demonstrate sensuality or courage or other well-known psychological traits in laboratory conditions. I mean, there are all sorts of human abilities that can't be studied except in real-life situations. If you want to study a tennis player's ability to return serves, you have to study that in the actual context of a game when opponents are trying their hardest to win. You can't do it in a lab.
No. I look around sometimes, like even in the field of mediumship, you know, we've devised a strict protocol with, you know, blinded studies, you know, right, up to, you know, quintuple, you know, blinding. And I sometimes read about these studies and I said, wow, if I was this entity in spirit, I would be confused as hell. I'm trying to follow the bouncing ball, you know, among five, you know.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. You talk about some great mediums in history, D.D. Hume and Carlos Mirabelli. When it comes to D.D. Hume, you often cite that case as you know, the case where he was able to produce, you know, music and motion in an accordion that was securely locked in a cage and under intense observation. You also mentioned that it's never been duplicated. You know, maybe that's because such things just can't be.
You mean if Hume was perpetrating some sort of trick?
No, I mean, just, you know, assuming that he wasn't a trick, you know, why? We've had other great mediums, physical mediums in history, and nobody's been able to replicate what he did.
Well, you know, think about it, other areas where we have prodigies and savants, people whose particular gifts are very idiosyncratic. We've never really had another Mozart. We've had lots of talented musicians and prodigiously talented musicians, but they're all distinctive. They have their own repertoire of phenomena.
Yeah. And you know, you devote a chapter in Dangerous Pursuits to the mediumship of Mirabelli, you know, considered to be one of the greatest physical mediums in history. Can you tell us a little bit of just some? I mean, it's the boggle threshold when you read about this, that, you know, and some of the things are just so incredible, that too incredible for people to believe. But can you get into just a few of the things, the phenomena that he was able to produce?
Yeah, sure. It's a test case for people, and it's a difficult one because there's no doubt that Mirabelli cheated on some occasions. So that just makes it even more problematical to unravel. But what's important, the really important residue about the case, is that Mirabelli produced full figure materializations in broad daylight or bright electric light, with lots of people watching very carefully. The full figure materializations could be tested for ordinary bodily functions. Doctors would testify that they heard the lungs, they heard stomach rumblings and other signs of ordinary bodily functions. And then the full figure materializations would dissolve or melt into the floor before everybody's eyes. And this went on for a long, long time.
Yeah, and you even mentioned that a doctor who was witnessing one of these materializations actually felt the person's pulse, which raises all sorts of questions. You know, that's impossible.
There was one case where there was a loud noise in the room, and to the amazement of everybody else, they found this old man present in the room, and two of the sitters recognized the phantom is that of a physician who had deceased recently. So they took photos of the form. They examined the form for about 15 minutes. Two medical men did this, and it appeared to be a normal human being. But after the examination was over, the figure dissolved away from the feet upwards until only the upper part of the body remained floating in the air. And then one of the doctors who had examined the figure rushed forward, and he sees the half of the body floating in front of him. And he cried out, and sank to the ground unconscious, while what was left of the body disappeared instantly. And when the doctor recovered, he told the sitters that what he felt was a spongy, flaccid mass of substance, and that then he experienced some kind of shock and fell to the ground.
So is it your assumption that these things were able to happen because of ectoplasm, you know, that the entities used as a medium by which they could carve out such materializations and images?
Well, ectoplasm is usually thought of as something that emanates from various parts of the medium's body. I mean, a lot of the cases where there are reports of ectoplasm, you see the material oozing from the nose or from the mouth or from the woman's vagina. So this is different. This is full figures separated from the medium who suddenly are there or who gradually appear. There was one case where there was a skull on a table, and one of the sitters, we learned afterwards, or they learned afterwards, had unconsciously or silently wished that the rest of the skeleton would be there, and gradually a skeleton formed under the skull. But this all happened away from the medium.
So we have to, after reading about things like that or even witnessing it, I mean, you have to form an opinion whether this is psychokinesis from a living entity or a group effort or psychokinesis from a discarnate, you know, entity.
Yes.
You know, so I guess that's the question, right?
That's one of the questions. The other question is, can we trust all these Brazilians? Yeah. And I think the answer is yes, but the British didn't seem to think so.
Yeah.
The British seem to think that unless you're a member in good standing of the Society for Psychical Research, your testimony was basically worthless.
Right. I can certainly understand that. You've also, which you go into great detail in Dangerous Pursuits, engaged in scientific investigation of a physical medium, you know, Kaimugi. And you witnessed some extraordinary phenomena, such as table levitations. And then you also caught some fraud. You know, as you mentioned, some of the greatest mediums engaged, even though they didn't have to, you know, engaged in fraud. So, I mean, when you, I'm interested more in your personal observation than your scientific one. I mean, when you discovered the fraud, I mean, were you surprised? I mean, was that something that you never thought? I know it was your job to do an investigation and let the, you know, chips fall where they may. But I would imagine after, you know, investigating them for quite some time and observing all the other physical phenomena, there must have been somewhat of a shock and disappointment.
Well, certainly disappointment. Yeah. I'm not sure that I was surprised, because I knew that Kai was making a living doing this, which I think is always a reason to smell danger when you're investigating somebody. So he has a certain kind of pressure on him to perform for paying customers. He doesn't want to disappoint them. And also he's trying to make a living as a kind of spiritist guru. And so the pressure on him is, I think, very great to produce all of the time. Mm. Even when I caught him cheating, what he said to me was, well, I can't admit that I cheated, which is not the same thing as saying that I didn't cheat.
Yeah, certainly not. It's a world of difference. Yeah. Well, but yet, you know, you had cameras and so forth, and the table levitations seemed all to be legit. I mean, you didn't find any evidence of fraud when you saw those things, did you?
No, I think Kai's the real deal.
Yeah.
But he's not reliable in this respect. So what we got, I mean, there were times when I was draped all over him in a darkened seance room, four limb control, and objects were moving around at well out of his reach. And I know he wasn't trying to reach because I was literally lying across his lap. And the table levitation's too good. I mean, I've felt the difference between a table levitating and somebody pushing up a table. They don't feel anything at all alike. When the table levitates, it feels buoyant. It feels weightless. Mm-hmm. And in the last series of sessions I had with Kai, the table was aloft for about 20 or 30 seconds, and it was swaying back and forth to the rhythm of the music. I think given the way we were seated and what's possible to do by oneself with the table, I think that's highly unlikely.
Mm. And now, Kai's explanation, when you talk to him about how levitations occur, was he convinced that it was, you know, spirit involvement, or that was he open to the idea that it could possibly like be the minds of the people that were present?
Well, Kai's smart, and he knows that that's a live option, at least in logical space. But given his at least attempted status as a spiritist guru, I don't think he would admit to that.
Yeah. The thing, you know, I just wanted to get back to Mirabelli a second. I mean, that is perplexing. these full form manifestations in daylight, and I say perplexing only because all the mediums I've encountered and everything that I've read and everything that I've watched, I mean, everybody insists on darkness, and the explanation is that light can affect the medium physically and cause them great physical harm. So the two don't mesh. Here we have these wildly successful manifestations in daylight, and why didn't he get sick?
It's not just Mirabelli. I mean, yeah. Hume did many things in decent light also. And this man in Buenos Aires I studied, Ariel Farias, he made tables rise also in brightly illuminated rooms. So, and, you know, it's similar to that. Mediums often claim that infrared recording suppresses the phenomena. But the fact is, and Kai knows this, I've video recorded in infrared a table levitation with him. So he knows it can happen. So you have to be a little suspicious when the medium starts protesting about this.
Yeah. So it has to be really frustrating to a scientist like yourself, who devotes so much time to these investigations. I mean, you're handcuffed. It seems like you can only go so far. You can't make a definitive judgment unless you can, introduce, some form of light. I guess it reaches a point where you have to question whether or not it pays to continue without having these controls in place.
It is frustrating, and yeah. Kai would allow controls up to a certain degree. I did strip searches of him. We did some sessions with him in an Austrian farmhouse that was isolated, and the seance room was locked. I had the key. Nobody knew where I had the key. And still, we couldn't rule out that Kai had simply regurgitated the ectoplasm we saw coming out of his mouth, even though he had eaten pizza and drank dark tea right before that.
Yeah.
You'll appreciate this, I know. We also couldn't rule out the rectal hypothesis.
Yeah. You've mentioned that before. That's certainly a viable hypothesis, to say the least.
We know that one medium actually did this, a Hungarian medium. He was famous for that.
Really?
Yes.
Well, thank goodness that you weren't involved in that investigation.
Well, I know how to do a strip search, but not a full cavity search. My philosophical training didn't prepare me for that.
They didn't teach that at the university, I don't think.
No.
I mentioned to you, once, I mean, I did, Fran and I did sit in a seance with Kai.
Yeah.
I'm going to say rapt, because it was very forceful, that I got, rapped with the floating trumpet, I would say between 10 and 15 times, on my head and my face and my and my shoulders. But I, you know, I walked away, you know, from it saying, wow, this is either, you know, this is some really incredible stuff, or it's a fraud. And I just felt helpless to make a decision one way or another. It was very unsatisfying because,
of course,
I didn't have any means of, and, you know, obviously I was just there as a guest. I didn't have a chance to examine anything. So I still, to this day, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to believe, you know, it was real, but how can I make a judgment? I have to rely on people like you for that.
It would have been helpful if somebody had been draped all across Kai so he couldn't have reached out into the room, and that his likely accomplices were controlled as well. But as I recall, you're telling me about that, there were no controls at all. Is that right?
No, there were controls. I mean, one person was the host of the gathering, and she was holding on to one of his hands, and then Kai's wife was the other control, you know, so on the other side. So, which of course raises other questions, but
well, that helps.
Yeah,
I mean, and I'm convinced that in sessions with me, there were things happening around the room that couldn't be explained in terms of Kai's or Julia's movements.
Right. The other thing that was so fascinating about Mirabelli, at least, you know, was the automatic writing. I mean, he could do automatic writing in 28 different languages. I don't know, you know, the investigators at the time must have believed that he was a channel for discarded entities. I mean, I don't know what his academic prowess was, but writing in 28 different languages seems beyond some fraudulent activity.
It certainly seems impressive, especially since, as reports have it, he couldn't speak his two native languages, Portuguese and Italian, perfectly either.
Yeah. And then also the spontaneous transportation, you know, I mean, this is Star
Yes,
Trek.
Yes, that's a great one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the most famous incident is where he spontaneously disappeared from the Sao Paulo train station where he had been talking with friends. They were all headed to a place 50 miles away. And according to witnesses, Mirabelli simply vanished from the platform where he'd been standing with them. And after about 15 minutes, the concerned friends got through by telephone to the home where they'd all been heading, and they were told that Mirabelli had been there for the past 15 minutes.
So I can't help thinking, you know, when I read that account, you know, in Dangerous Pursuits, your new book, if let's say that case of transportation occurred today, where the medium was surrounded by, you know, credible researchers, you would say to yourself, well, you know, things would be different now. I mean, this would represent, at the very least, definitive proof that we're more than our physical bodies, you know. But, you know, and it makes me angry sometimes. Like, why can't we witness that again? It's only we read about it in books. But do you think that we'll ever see somebody that's capable of such feats now?
It may require a certain kind of nurturing atmosphere in the culture as a whole. And I think Brazil can boast that, or at least it could. I mean, it's not that there were no skeptical people in Brazil, but Spiritist beliefs were held very widely. So it was more consistent with the prevailing gestalt than I think it would be in certain other countries. And presumably there are pretty amazing things that happen in other parts of the world where the worldviews are quite different from that of most industrialized or developed countries.
Mm. So let's talk about one of your other favorite subjects, you know, the nature of psi itself and, you know, and what we term super psi. It's a concept that's commonly used by people that are skeptical of survival, you know, because they point out that people like mediums are always just as if it was a simple task, you know, connecting to information fields and can extract information, you know, out of those fields, which they repeat, you know, to the sitter. You consider that the very concept of super psi to be defective. So how so?
Well, first of all, it's extremely unclear. What's super for one person may not be super for another. It's not as if there's an objective scale of amazingness or complexity. As Charles Richer once noted, the materialization of a finger is every bit as impressive as the materialization of an entire body. I mean, both are pretty miraculous. And I think there's something prejudicial about the term super psi right to begin with. I think most people treat the word super and super psi as more similar to its use in superhero than in, say, super glue. I mean, we understand what we mean by super glue. It's just really damn fine glue. But super psi is more like superhero, where we suppose that it's antecedently incredible right from the beginning.
So, I mean, if there is unlimited psi, then it's a very difficult task for science ever to prove survival, because
yes,
we can never rule it out.
That is the challenge. Yeah. And I mean, there are always options in logical space, but even though you can't rule it out with the kind of certitude that I think a lot of people in science would like, it doesn't mean there can't be persuasive arguments against it. So in my book, Immortal Remains, I go through lots of reasons for thinking that if you were faced with something close to what I've laid out as potentially ideal cases of postmortem survival, it would be irrational in some important sense to deny that people survive their bodily death, even if we couldn't prove it in a more rigorous way.
Yeah, and as you point out, you know, in the book, I mean, when it comes to psychic functioning, you know, or these striking cases, you know, we recognize the striking cases, but we may be constantly interacting with other minds all of the time. You know, so that makes it even more difficult, I guess, to, you know, to parse any differences between, you know, survival and psi. And what about the nature of psi itself? I mean, it's more likely for people to be able to communicate mind to mind if they have some sort of a relationship, like a family member or a strong acquaintance.
I take issue with that?
Yeah.
Sure. I think we're certainly more likely to know about apparent psi interactions between people who are close or who know each other and are likely to be talking about things. But for all we know, psi could be happening between perfect strangers, and that's why we have various kinds of intrusive and unexpected and surprising thoughts some of the time. I mean, those cases are unlikely to be discovered.
Mm. What about, do you subscribe to the, you know, the theory, you know, like that was discussed by William James and others, you know, that the brain acts as a filter or a reducing valve, you know, which enables us to function in this physical world, whereas we're not, otherwise we'd always be bombarded by information?
Well, I'm sympathetic to that. I mean, it may be a limiting factor in our particular incarnation right now. Similarly, it would be terribly inconvenient for most people to remember everything that happens. Now, there are people who do remember every event in their lives, and they face cognitive challenges that most of us don't have to worry about. There's a wonderful book by S.J. Luria called The Mind of a Nemanist, and he studies in detail one person with photographic memory whose life was severely impaired by his inability to forget.
Hmm. Yeah, that's that might have been it's hard for people to grasp. Could you imagine that? It's somewhat of a burden, I would think.
It was for him. And yeah. So it may be that one of our ordinary physiological functions is to reduce the incoming information to manageable proportions.
Mm. It's just sometimes I find it so frustrating that we're so it seems like we're hopelessly deadlocked in trying to, you know, if a discarnate gets information through by psychic means and communicates through a medium through psychic means, it's almost impossible to separate the two. I mean, the strongest arguments, I think, are that, when the medium takes on the personality, or talks about the deceased's, love or appreciation for music or art, whereas that would seem to be more difficult than or not available in extracting these pieces of data out of an information field.
But, yes. Yeah. Yes. And that's one of the reasons I'm impressed by the case of Leonora Piper, because she produced high quality apparent communications for about a quarter of a century. And if, as you noted, we could be unconsciously interacting psychically with all sorts of people and things in our vicinity and even not in our vicinity, then there's this massive underlying causal nexus of interactions that could either enhance or even interfere with our particular psychic achievement. So I think the more super we allow our psychic functioning to be, the more limitless we allow it to be, the more potential obstacles in the underlying causal nexus. It's like the case of the world's greatest assassin. No matter how good the person is, doesn't mean that he'll always succeed at his task, because the potential victim could erect defenses, or more interestingly, the assassin could be stymied by things that have nothing to do with his particular mission. He's just caught in the crossfire. So even if he's the world's greatest assassin, he could be interfered with by a flat tire or a case of the flu or a broken elevator or a car accident or something of that sort.
Mm. Well, that might also be an explanation why not everyone is able to get communication from discarnate entities. And, and it seems like only some discarnate entities are able to communicate, and only some people in the physical are able to receive the information. So I guess there is a lot of interference, and there has to be some sort of a resonance between the different parties for it to happen.
Maybe the resonance facilitates it. I'm certainly open to that. But yeah. this is related to the question of another question. Some people have said to me, well, Browdy, you think that thoughts can kill. And then why are so many mothers and children alive today? And my usual answer to that is, well, just because thoughts can kill doesn't mean they will. They're all, just like with the case of the assassin, there could be all sorts of natural obstacles to successful employment of your or realization of your wishes.
Mm. You, in Dangerous Pursuits, you also get into a discussion of music. You know, many people might find that surprising. I'll tell you what did resonate with me, in reading that is, you write about how a musician's personality very well, most of the time it affects their music, their style and their composition of music seems to be correlated with their personalities. And the reason I resonated with that is because I find that all the time with mediums and in the way that they deliver their information, it's surprisingly consistent with their personalities. I mean, people, the mediums that I know that in everyday life are shy and reserved, they speak after a well thought out process. They're the same way when they deliver the information. So it seems to be, I would imagine that would be true with musicians, just the way it would be with mediums.
Well, sometimes with musicians, though, their musical selves and their social selves are a little bit different. So some musicians who are socially very retiring might be more assertive musically. And I wonder if you find that with mediums, too.
Occasionally. Sometimes you're surprised. I say, well, where did that come from? You have this, this kind of shy, timid thing, and then all of a sudden they start doing reading and they're coming online. But more often than not, You know, and I'd say probably 80 to 90% of the time there seems to be a match. You know, some are somewhat frenetic in their personalities, and they seem like they're a little ADD. And then when they're doing readings, the information is flowing like crazy, like machine gun fire. You know, just giving in, you know, in, you know, fact or information, pieces of information, one after another in rapid fire. So, and others. You know, just the opposite. But you're right. I mean, sometimes I would imagine with just as you see with musicians, you're shocked. totally different, you know, personalities. So you've been as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, editor in chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration.
Not much longer, I hope.
I know, and I was going to ask you. I mean, any specific reasons, or is it just time to move on?
I'm like the old guy who goes to the doctor and says, "Doc, I can't pee." And the doctor says, "How old are you?" He says, "I'm 95." And the doctor says, "You've peed enough." 12 yeah. years is enough at the helm.
Yeah, I think so. I certainly appreciate that. So ultimately, and I'm just talking now from a survival perspective. I believe that it's not going to be science as much as we always say that it will be. I have doubts whether science is really going to ever be able to prove, you know, that we survive our physical deaths. I think what may turn the corner and change worldview would be personal proof. You know, when personal experiences are shared and it reaches a certain point where it becomes, you know, sort of mainstream. I mean, maybe then, you know, things will be more accepted and kind of taken as fact. I mean, the anecdotal evidence is so, you know, overwhelming that, you know, maybe it's just the sheer numbers that'll turn the corner. But I mean, what do you think? Do you think science one day will be able to prove life after death?
It's a good question. I'm not sure how. But I agree with you about the force of anecdotal cases, some more than others, of course. And what has always particularly intrigued me are the transplant cases. And there was, I assume you know about the transplant cases.
Yeah.
And there was one in particular that struck me, and it was of a young boy who received a heart or lung transplant, I can't recall which. And the good thing about this being a young boy is that children at certain ages have not had the possibility of certain things ruled out for them in their educational upbringing. I mean, usually children perform better on psychic tests than they do later on when they've been told what's possible and what's impossible. So I forget if the transplant recipient's name was Jerry or Carter. It's one of the two. The other is the donor. Let's say it was Jerry who was the recipient. When he was asked what's going on, I mean, he would behave in ways that were very similar to the donor, Carter. He would run up to the donor's mother and nuzzle the way that Carter used to do. And when asked about it, he said, "Well, Carter is with me all the time. I just let him out sometimes."
Hmm.
And it may be that kind of apparently naive testimony is actually more accurate than what we might get from other sorts of recipients, heart lung recipients, who already have well entrenched beliefs about what is and what is not possible.
Mm. That makes sense. What do you make of the cases of involving people that mostly children that are autistic and have these highly evolved psychic abilities, whereas you know, their brains are obviously impaired in some way, and yet they can be extraordinary when it comes to non-physical stuff. Do you think there's a connection there that we need to look at more closely?
Well, I think there are a number of related kinds of cases. There are those, there are so-called savants, used to be called idiot savants, and there are prodigies. I mean, we don't understand what's going on in those cases. In the case of savants, you've got, for example, calculating savants who can factor any number you give to them, but who can't add the change in their pocket. There's a famous musical savant who's spastic until he sits down to play the piano. So we see in these cases people who have various kinds of deficits that you wouldn't expect to occur alongside their remarkable skills. And so it's not as if, there's so much conceptual legwork that has yet to be done that's relevant to the study of survival. I try to do a little bit of it in Immortal Remains, but we don't really understand the nature of human abilities. I think we need to get clear on what we mean by various abilities and what an ability is and how to understand what abilities are.
Mm. I was just reflecting back on what we were discussing earlier, and because it was repeating in my mind, like, you know, why, just changing the subject again, why mediums, you know, cheat, and you know, some of these great mediums in history. And yeah, I noticed that in today's mental mediums, even among those who are very, very, you know, gifted and have strong mediumistic ability, sometimes they'll take the easy way out, you know, because it's hard, I guess, to, you know, to keep it flowing. And so they might interject their conscious interpretation or, you know, filler and so forth, when there's really no reason that they should do that. I think it may have something to do with us putting them in the role of performers. You know, when we look at them and they see, yes, they don't want to appear to be struggling, you know, and, you know, I don't want to say dead air, if it's a bad pun, but, you know, the people take them not speaking as an indication of weakness, you know, so they need to keep things going while they're gearing up. So I know that I guess it must have been similar to the physical mediums back in the day. I mean, some of them, like you mentioned, they were extraordinary, and yet they have these periods of fraud. It's a little mind-boggling, you know, but it's understandable.
And it's so unnecessary. I mean, if you think about sports analogies, a baseball hitter is good if he gets a hit one out of three times.
Yeah, yeah, I know. And, you know, we also, especially with mediums, we create this false perception, you know, with these TV shows and media. You know, I recall, you know, one of the mediums that we had certified, you know, telling me that they did a reading, and then, you know, the sitter said that they were not satisfied. And then she said, well, you know, why is that? Because I thought it was a very strong reading, you know. And then the sitter said, well, you got something wrong, you know. And then she went on to say, well, yeah, but, you know, I mean, if you referred to your notes, I probably was about 85 to 90%, you know, accurate. And then the woman said, well, so-and-so on TV never gets anything wrong. You know, so, you know, they're talking about comparing an edited, you know, TV show versus, you know, reality. So it's an impossible standard, you know.
So you remind me of an incident when Tony Edwards did the BBC special many years ago, the case for Psy, I forget, or the case for ESP. He filmed the skeptic C.E.M. Hansel, and Hansel said, well, it should be very easy for someone to prove that he has telepathic abilities. He just has to tell me what I'm thinking. And I'm so sorry that Tony didn't reply to him. He said, oh, is that so, Mr. Hansel? Well, let's see a penile erection. I'm sure Hansel wouldn't have agreed that he was incapable of it simply because he couldn't get it up then and there.
No. Well, see, you appreciate that story because of your involvement in the debate teams, you know, back at the university. I mean, that would have been a great thing to put up. So what does the future hold for you now? I mean, you've written your seventh book, you're retiring from the editor in chief position. Your music seems to be getting stronger. So are you leaning more in that direction as you?
Well, I want to spend more time on music. It's not getting stronger because I've been neglecting it. And early stage Parkinson's isn't helping either. But I can still play piano, and I'd like to be playing more of it. And I'll tell you, it was very constructive to write the chapter on music for Dangerous Pursuits, because I've been drenched in nostalgia about my musical history ever since. I mean, do you have time for an anecdote?
Sure.
I mean, this has nothing to do with survival, but
yeah,
I have to set the stage for this. I hadn't thought about this until recently. My first professional gig in a club was in 1961 in Cincinnati. And before that, I was playing the Jewish dinner party circuit in Cincinnati. But so this was the first time I played in a club. And in 1961, that was the tail end of the Beat generation. And in those days, to be hip was to be cool. And to be cool was to never really show your feelings. So the hip way to express your appreciation, if you're in the audience, would be to snap your fingers or just say, yeah. So yeah. It was like playing for zombies.
Right.
And so I'm in this club and I'm playing for zombies. And in walk my parents and some friends from the Metropolitan Opera, famous basso profundo from Greece, Nicola Moscona and his Greek wife Antigone. So four very demonstrative people. So I play for the zombies and the zombies go, yeah. And my parents' table breaks out into this outlandish applause. And they're saying, bravo, bravo. And Moscona in his deep voice is saying, bravo, Stevie. Bravo, my boy. Bravo. I felt so embarrassed. I wanted to crawl between the cracks of the keys. They were so uncool. But the fact is they were having the only genuine reaction in the house. Everybody else was posturing.
That's very true. I was just watching. I watch so much TV at night these days that I forget what I was watching. But it was that the same scene you just portrayed. A guy took his daughter to one of these hip poetry things, and the daughter wanted to applaud, and he was like appalled. No. You snap your fingers, snap your fingers. So it reminded me of that. That's true in general. I mean, I think we hide our emotions more often than we express them in general.
I think you're right.
Yeah, I don't know if that's changed much. So. This has been great to catch up. Is there another book in the works, you think? Or,
well, maybe one on how cats spend their time. I don't know.
Well, you do have some experience with that.
I do, but yes. I should write one really on how pigs spend their time.
I was just going to say, I you took the words right out of my mouth. I remember that. There aren't too many of my friends that had pet pigs, but you're one of them. Well, I thank you for being with us, and hope to talk to you again soon. And
me too. Thank you very much.
Good luck. And I wanted to tell everybody, the book is Dangerous Pursuits, Mediumship, Mind, and Music. You can, I'm sure, pick it up in any outlet, including Amazon, which seems to have all the books. They have 90% of the market these days from what I'm experiencing. So good luck with the book. I recommend you pick it up, and we'll talk to you soon, Steve.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, Bye-bye. Take care. And now, as we do with most of our shows, I will go into our peace prayer. Let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man as well as the earth and its environment. And good night, everyone, and we will see you next week.